The drum in Native culture goes back a very long time. Before we had the wooden ring and the skin over the top of that, what we would do is we would dig out a pit in the ground, and then everybody, the guys that were drumming and singing, would pull an animal hide tight, and then they'd hit it with sticks. And that would be what we'd use for the drum, because it would reverberate down into the pit in the ground and come out. And years later, they figured out how to make wooden rings and put the skin around the wooden rings. But long before there were horses here, we had the drum. And so the drum has always been a part of Native culture, be it spiritually or in a celebratory way. And the song I just sang was a Mother's Appreciation song, being that we're giving thanks. So that song is a Kiowa song, but there's no words to it, but it was written in appreciation of the mothers. So, you know, we have songs that are prayer songs, we have songs that are honoring songs, we have songs that are remembrance songs, we have songs for basically anything, because the drum is an essential part of who and what we are as Native people.
And tell us about the language. So what you were singing, is that a particular language?
No, what I was singing, this goes into, when powwows started, the Omaha people in Nebraska started having powwows, and what would happen is you'd have all these tribes come together, and they all speak different languages, and so that everybody could enjoy the songs that were being sung, they would start singing what's called vocables, which is what I was just singing, and they're not words per se, they're just sounds that we make, and that's where people think that we chant. Native people don't chant, but we sing in vocables so that people that don't know each other's languages can still enjoy the songs in the same way.
It seems like it comes from such a heart and soul place when I hear it. It's almost better than hearing something in English. Anybody else experience that? You know, there's just the depth of resonance with it. Yeah, you feel that, imagine, as you sing.
Oh, I don't know, I just sing, it comes out.
It works.
You know, we've all been given our gifts and whatnot, and I've been singing now for 25 years, and I feel that was one of my gifts I was given that I have to share. So I sing, and I enjoy singing. It's one of the things that, you know, makes me who I am. I love to sing.
Well, it's our great blessing that we get to have you here today. I don't know if all of you know, Mark Tertelet was our YOU sponsor for about 6.5 years here. Yeah, most of the YOUers. I know you all are very glad to have him back this Sunday. And Mark has recently moved. In August, he moved to take care of his father in New Jersey, and or to be with his father, anyway. And so we're really glad to have you back this Sunday, and especially to share these very sacred teachings and music and your love and singing and drumming, and you. We're just glad to have you.
Thank you. No, it's good to be back. It feels weird to be back after being gone so long. It's so warm here right now. I'm like cooking right now because I'm so used to the cold already.
Yeah, right, you've adjusted quickly. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your lineage, your ancestral lines, your father and your mother both have. Okay.
So my dad is full-blood Indian. My dad was born on the Menominee Indian Reservation in Wisconsin. My dad is Menominee, Ojibwe, and Ho-Chunk. And my mother was Chinook, Blackfoot, and Sicilian. My mother's side of the family does not acknowledge their native side because her dad was kind of not a very good guy, so they distance themselves from that part of their family. So if you ask any of my family on that side, they all say they're Italian. My dad, however, was born and raised on the Menominee Indian Reservation, and it's my dad. I think, fortunate enough to be raised. I was never raised in a Western Christian environment. I was always raised in a traditional Native environment. And so the Native spirituality that I carry with me now is the Native spirituality that I was raised with from, you know, a little kid. So I have probably a little bit of a different way of looking at the world or seeing the world than most people do. And, you know, it's something that permeates in every day or every facet of my life. You know, just the way I see the world is different, and it's how I was raised.
Tell us a little bit about that. Like, what were some of the key teachings or the way of praying? Or...
Yeah, the big thing, one of the big things is, you know, we as Native people, and again, I'll preface this by saying, before European colonization, there were 500 separate nations in the continental United States alone. So what I'm telling you is just my point of view on it. You're going to find people that say different things, and none of us are wrong and none of us are right. It's just what's right for us. One of the big things is, though, you know, the way we look at the Creator, in Western Christian, you say God, and that you believe you're made in the image of God. Well, as Native people, we think that's arrogant. Our word is, in my language, we say Kishimanito, which means the great unknown, the great mystery, the great power. And Native people think that we're no better than dogs, cats, birds, bees, snakes, fish. We consider ourselves just part of the same circle of life. And so for us to think that we're elevated to be created in the image of the Creator is absolute arrogance to our way of thinking. So that was like the first big hang-up when we met the Europeans. It's the whole way you look at the Creator. And the other big thing that I was taught is, I was taught, anyway, like I said, this is my own personal, that when we're born, the Creator gives us all the gifts we'll ever need to succeed in our life. So I was taught when we pray, we start off by saying, thank you. We never ask for anything for ourselves. You know, I've never prayed for money. I've never prayed for a job. I've never prayed for anything other than to give thanks for the things I was given, or I would pray for other people. I would pray for other people's health. I would pray for other people to get help. So like in my language, there's another word we use. We say Mawakosano, which means the Creator. And we start off our prayers by saying Mawakosano Mekwawanan. And that's Creator, thank you for everything. And that's how we start our prayers as Menominee people. And so that's the way we pray. We never pray for ourselves unless we're giving thanks. We pray for other people.
Mm-hmm. And do you? Is there anything with the directions or offerings that are part of your prayer practice? Or have they been in the past?
They can be. Again, you're going to find different things, but I was taught we believe in seven sacred directions. There's north, south, east, and west. Those are all sacred directions because that's the different ways the winds blow. There's the above direction, there's the below direction, and then there's the direction that's within. And those are the seven sacred directions for my people. And the four directions of the compass have colors, which are white, yellow, red, and black. And again, that changes from tribe to tribe because some of them have blue, some of them have green, some of them have them in different orientations. So it's, you know, I can tell you what I know, but, you know, that's where the directions come from. And generally, all of us start off by praying to the east because that's where the sun rises and that's where Natives believe life start is on the east.
Beautiful. So begin your prayers at sunrise and then end them at the end of the day at sunset?
Yep.
Sounds like a good rhythm, doesn't it?
But again, like I said, that's not, you know, I was told that you don't have to be anywhere special to pray. As Natives, we believe that we're in church wherever we are, be it in our car, sitting in traffic, sitting in DMV, sitting out on the lawn. Anywhere that you feel like you need to pray is a good place to pray, and there's no specific time for you to pray either. We're not like the Muslims where they have the five times a day where they got to pray or anything like that. It's a very personal religion. There's no wrong way to do it. It's your relationship with the Creator is yours specifically, yours exclusively, and there's no wrong way to do it.
I like that you use the DMV, besides the fact that it made us all laugh. But it's also the indoor-outdoor idea. So, you know, nature is everywhere present, I guess it would be. I mean, of course, we all feel a certain resonance when we're out in nature.
Right.
That's a little bit different.
I prefer to pray outside, but that doesn't mean that that's the only place I have to do it.
So how was it for you then when you got involved in Unity? I mean, was it easy to blend the paths, or was it kicking and screaming? Or, you know, I know he met Kathy, and she's saying kicking and screaming. Kathy grew up in Unity, right?
Yeah. When I first met Kathy and Pat, I was close to 26 years ago now, and I was not the same man I am now. I was still a fairly angry young man. And they were like, oh, you know, we're going to have kids and they're going to go to church. And I'm like, no kid of mine is ever going to a Christian church. The things you say in ignorance, you know. And then I think when the old building was here, I came a few times to the old building. And I went a few times when we were meeting over at Heather Farms. And then we came here and I started coming with Kathy, and I was like, oh, these people look at things kind of a bit different, you know, they see things a little weird. And at the time, Reverend David was talking about Winnie the Pooh, and I'm going, what the, you know, but his messages, he was saying things and I would look and everybody would be like, oh, wow, that's amazing. And I'd lean over to Kathy and say, well, we look at it like this. And she looked at me like, you knew that already? I go, well, I knew that, but I knew it in this way. And she said something to me. One day we were sitting on the patio talking, and she goes, I think you guys are the only ones that never lost your instructions. I was like, I don't know about that. You know, the way that we see the world is very simple, I think. And when you take all the superfluous things out of your life and you look at what's left and what's simple, it's easy to see the way that you should be, I think, maybe.
Yeah, I appreciated when we were talking earlier, you were saying, you know, one of the things for you is just to be the best person you can be and do the best you can do with the gifts you've been given, which is we've been given everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's... I used to drive her crazy because I firmly believe that I can do anything I set my mind to. You know, I give me enough time, I could learn how to be a brain surgeon. And I fully believe I have that ability because it's what I was given at birth. I took the path in life that I chose because I felt it was the right one for me, but I could have gone myriads of different ways and I could have been just as successful as I am right now. And I believe that everyone has that. It's just nobody believes it anymore. But everybody has the same abilities.
Yeah. Well, and the path you have taken has been a lot of teaching younger people and really working with youth. Tell us a little bit about why that's important to you and what the context is.
Well, the context there is our culture, Native culture traditionally, I know this is going to surprise a lot of you, but Native culture traditionally, we were a very warlike warrior culture, and that's just what we were. A man's sole occupation, at least in our tribe, used to be fighting or hunting, and that was it. That's all a man practiced to do, was to fight or to hunt. And we don't have that kind of a culture anymore, so the role of a warrior has switched a little bit. We are still, per capita, the natives have the highest rate of enrollment in the military. It's 64% of all living natives are either veterans or active service, so that's still a big part of our culture. But we also look at the main role of a warrior now as a protector, and what's the best way we can protect ourselves. The best way to protect ourselves is to make sure the generation behind us has the tools and the skills they need to take over for us. Everyone in this room, you're going to be replaced if you haven't been replaced already. You're going to be replaced by someone younger. It's going to happen. And our thought is the best way for us to ensure the person that replaces us is to teach them everything we know. And so our role has kind of changed a little bit now to where it's very important for us to educate the generation behind us. And so I've actually been involved in youth education for almost 25 years now. Before I was with YOU, I was doing Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts, and before that, I worked at the Indian Education Program in Martinez that works for the school districts around here. And I would teach culture, I would teach drumming and singing, and I would be a tutor for the kids. One of the gentlemen that's actually on our drum group that we go to powwows with was one of my students. So it's very important for me and for us as a culture to pass on everything we can to the generation behind us. to lift them up, to make them stronger, because the stronger they are, the more they're going to hold us up when we get to the age where we can't do as much.
Yeah, beautiful. That idea of many, you know, thinking about our impact for many generations, seven generations often,
right,
to come is really powerful. And you're doing the good work of directly working with youth. So thank you for that, for the work you've done here.
Thank you.
And out in the world. And you mentioned powwows. Tell us a little bit, because I know the drum features, in, and you and your brothers play the large drum and sing together at powwows. And
what they are now is, I think, I mean, you know, my own opinion, I think they're a continuation of our culture and our heritage. If you guys have never been to a powwow, go to a powwow. There's one almost every weekend within a couple hours drive from here. There's one next weekend somewhere in Oakland. The best one I would say to go to is the Stanford Powwow on Mother's Day weekend. That's one of the biggest ones in Northern California, and it's amazing. But what it is, you know, we get together and you'll have the drums and the dancers and all their traditional clothing will be dancing. And it's, to me, it's the most beautiful thing. I love it. I enjoy it very much. And, you know, the first time I lived on the reservation for a while when I was a real young kid. And then I went back when I was 18 because my grandpa was sick. And that was the first time I saw a powwow when I was 18 years old. And I was blown away. You know, here I am, this rough and tumble, streetwise 18-year-old kid with tears streaming down my face because I couldn't believe what I was looking at. And the funny thing was, I'm like, looking at the dancers, that didn't appeal to me, but I wanted to sing. The drumming and the singing, I was like, that's what I want to do. And so, you know, I ended up, here I am now, I'm a drummer and singer, and I've been doing it for like 25 years, and to me it's been the most amazing thing. But, you know, definitely, anybody should be able to go to any powwow. They're wonderful. Go see it. Eat an Indian taco. Eat fried bread. It's good stuff. If you've never had fried bread, your life will change when you eat it.
Well, I've been to some powwows too, and one of the beautiful things to me is that all these different tribes are coming together. I mean, that is essentially a key part of it, right? To bring each other together.
Yeah, the thing... after World War II, the United States government implemented a policy called relocation, and it backfired on them. It was awesome. What relocation was is they were taking Native families from the reservation, giving them money, and setting them up in urban environments so that they could assimilate us into white society. Well, they screwed up because they put us all in the same areas. The Bay Area has one of the highest Native populations in the entire country. There's an incredibly vibrant and thriving Native community in the Bay Area, and it stretches from San Jose all the way up to Santa Rosa and even beyond that. And there's a place in Oakland that's kind of like the epicenter for the East Bay called Intertribal Friendship House, where every Thursday night they have drumming and dancing and singing lessons there. And that's, you know, I've been involved with those guys for years. And so their whole thing about relocation has turned against them. And, you know, we jokingly call Oakland the urban res. Like, you'll see people at powwows that wear t-shirts that say urban res on it. And that's what we consider Oakland, is the urban reservation. So, you know, the powwow and that whole thing, it pulls us all together as a community. And it's very important to us to keep our culture alive.
You mentioned earlier that you were angry when you were a young man. And I imagine that might have been a little bit of anger at the white man.
Yeah, misdirected.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So how did you, it was a forgiveness process, or what did you do to move through that?
Well, there was two things. One, I realized that nobody alive, my anger was just vapid. There was nowhere for it to go. It was a misplaced anger because there was nobody to be angry at. And two, by holding on to that anchor, I was basically making myself a victim. And I'm not a victim, and nobody alive today had anything to do with what happened all those years ago. So I got to the point, in a point in maturity, where it was just pointless and useless to hang on to. There was no reason to hang on to it.
Beautiful. Well, that is, I love how you simplify teachings that we spend, you know, days on. And he brings it right to the essence, right? Well, I know also one of the great aspects of Native heritage is storytelling. I wonder if you'd be willing to share with us a story.
Yeah, actually, you guys get a bonus story. I told one story in the morning for the morning service, you guys get a different story. So the Menominee people were from the Great Lakes in Wisconsin. Our reservation is about 45 minutes just northwest of Green Bay. It's absolutely beautiful. There's a pristine river that runs through it called the Wolf River, and it's just gorgeous. It's one of my favorite places on the planet. And on our reservation, there's a rock called Spirit Rock, and I'm going to tell you the legend of Spirit Rock. A long time ago, there was a hero god named Manabush, and Manabush made himself be known to this one young man. He said, grab 20 of your strongest warriors and come find me at my house, and my house is here, and it's going to be a very dangerous trip for you. So they go, he gets the 20 bravest people from the tribe, and they go to where Manabush said to go, and the first thing they come to is the river, and there's no way to cross the river. And one of them heard a vision in his head saying, you know, you have to trust yourself and jump across the river. Well, the river's massive. But the young man that heard that just started running, and he jumped and he went across the river. So everybody went and jumped across the river except for one guy. He didn't make it and got carried away down the river, and I was never told what happened to him. And so they keep going, and they finally get to Manabush's hut, Manabush's house, and Manabush says, all of you have come, you're brave warriors, and I can see that all of you care about your people. So I'm going to grant each one of you a wish. So one guy says, you know, I want to be the greatest leather worker in the tribe. And one guy's like, I want to be the best hunter. And one guy's like, I want to be the best warrior. I want to be the best fisherman. I want to make the best canoes, because we used a lot of canoes. In fact, they call us Menominee. The word for ourselves is Anishinaabe. Menominee means people of the rice, and that's because when the French people came, the first time they saw us, we were in our canoes getting rice out of the rivers. So they said, ah, you're the rice people. We're like, what? So one guy's like, I want to make the best canoes, and it went down the line, and everybody wanted to be something useful. And he came back to the first warrior, and the first warrior goes, you know what? I want to live forever so I can watch over the people. And Manabush became enraged because he thought that was a very arrogant and a very selfish want to not be able to die. So he goes, okay, you'll live as long as the Menominee people live. And he put his hand on top of his head and he pushed him down and turned him into a rock and said, so long as you're still a rock, there will be Menominee people. Now, Spirit Rock's on our reservation. I've been to it. And the thing about Spirit Rock that's a little bit scary is there's chips of rock laying around it. And the legend is each time a Menominee dies, a piece of the rock falls off.
Mm. So story. Wow. Interesting that we have a Spirit Rock nearby of a different flavor, the Buddhist Spirit Rock Center up here.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's, you know, a different story, but that's one that comes specifically from my people.
Mm. Beautiful. Thank you for sharing. Your music, your singing, your drumming, and your stories. Really appreciate it.
And just one last thing. I'm sure none of you know this, but this is Native American Heritage Month, so go try to learn about a Native American person. There's millions to choose from. Well, not millions, but there's quite a few. I would suggest Chief Joseph or Chief Seattle. Chief Seattle especially, because he had a lot of sayings that go along with a lot of what Unity believes. And Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce people is the one that was famously said, I'll fight no more forever. Learn about him, read about him, read about somebody who's native, please. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark.